Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. We have four bills on the agenda. We'll not be able to vote on them until we have a quorum, but we can start with by hearing Senate File 2494, Senator Saxog. Senate File 2494, Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the member. Presenting Senate File 2494, this is a resolution that is a result of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee's extensive work over the interim. And what we're working on, of course, is helping school trust funds generate more revenue to the school trust fund for those lands that are embedded in the BWCA. Mr. Chair, I'd like to start out by just reading the resolution. It's very short, but it explains itself, I think, very well. Whereas the federal government granted the state school trust lands for a source of continued revenue for the betterment of public schools throughout the state, and whereas the legislature established the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee to advise the Department of Natural Resources on the management of school trust land, and whereas the school trust lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness do not generate any revenue to the Permanent School Fund, now therefore be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it affirms the recommendation of the subcommittee to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee to support negotiations with the United States Forest Service on the sale and exchange of school trust lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Be it further resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it affirms the recommendations of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee to include in those negotiations a hybrid model that would provide for both the sale and exchange of school trust lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness for federal lands outside the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Be it further resolved that the Secretary of State of the State of Minnesota is directed to transmit copies of this memorial to Minnesota senators and representatives in Congress, the Secretary of Agriculture, and the Director of the United States Forest Service. So, Mr. Chair, this is this resolution involves roughly 85,000 acres of embedded school trust land in the Boundary Waters. The discussions, as is noted here, went on a hybrid, including a combination of an exchange and an actual sale. Has been kind of worked out. The exchange would be roughly a third, or about 27,000 acres of the total work done. I guess the last thing I would say is that Representative Rukavina saw me last night, and he said, "You know, I did that. I did something like that 10 years ago." And I said, "Tom, there's a couple of major changes that have happened since then." One, as you note, Senator Lynch authored a bill which said any income coming out of the school trust fund any income that comes out of the school trust fund lands that goes into the school trust fund will not supplant any longer the funds in the general fund. In other words, that income coming out of there used to go into the school trust fund, and an immediate amount of money would have to go into the general fund. That's no longer the case. It now supplants it. So, you know, that obviously makes a huge difference. It hardly made a difference before. The other thing, the last 5 to 10 years, I think we've worked very hard on forest management, and now find that we can exchange with the federal government, and they understand this too, that the consolidation of forest lands makes them more valuable, makes them easier to manage, and is generally a good thing. One additional benefit is that when we do these exchanges with the federal government around the portions of northeastern Minnesota that have mineral deposits, we're finding that in some cases there are state mineral rights that are embedded underneath federal lands. So surface rights and mineral rights are not always coordinated. And this exchange may allow us to match those up. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any type of questions. Kathy Lewis from the Department of Natural Resources, the specialist in lands, is here to answer any additional questions.
Questions? This is a, just to add my two cents, this is a topic that flies under the radar but is absolutely critical not only to education but our land use policies in Minnesota. And when we talk about and sometimes get frustrated with the checkerboard effect of our public lands on a map, this is a step in addressing that, as well as the education issue, education funding issue. And the this advisory committee is new. It was created by statute and began meeting over the last year and had a lot of important discussions. And I correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Sacksog, it's the first time that really all of the stakeholders on this issue sat around at the same table on a regular basis to hash out the issues affecting these types of lands.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And I don't see any, if we are going to do anything with boundary water exchanges, I don't see any other way than this process with everyone exchanging ideas and having a dialogue.
One other note before Senator Dibble's question is that I think we've included in there an article from the Utah Gazette, or maybe it's from the New York Times, on a land exchange that was done in Utah. Representative Dietrich, who is counterpart of this resolution in the House, spent some time out in Utah noting the way that they've been working on their land exchanges, their school trust lands and federal lands. So that was completed just recently. So that's kind of gives us hope that this could be done with some degree of speed.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think it's a whole lot better than some other approaches that have been suggested by someone whom you cited earlier, who was talking about opening up their boundary waters for a little revenue generation activities. And pardon me if I missed it, but do we have an estimate on how much we might anticipate adding to the coffers of the school trust?
Senator Sacksog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that's a good question. All these are round numbers, I'm going to throw some numbers out, but until there's actual appraisals done, you know, you really can't. But the total, it is thought that the total of 85,000 acres is probably estimated market value of about $100 million. Given the exchange, that would probably reduce that by 30%. The 27,000 acres that would be exchanged out. So we could be talking about $60 million would be going to the trust fund.
Thanks.
Follow up?
You mentioned stakeholders, and I see in the New York Times article that environmental groups have been frustrated by the circumstances in Utah. Have the environmental groups been a part of this discussion and conversation? Are they?
It has. They were part.
Agreeable?
They were the stakeholders, and right. And again, this was a unanimous vote when we got to the end of our subcommittee.
Thanks.
What question was there any representatives from the federal government on the committee or ever come?
Yes. Mr. Chair, one of the key members of the committee ex officio is Superintendent Jim Sanders of the Superior National Forest. And he, as well as the key people from the DNR, were at the table all the time.
Okay. If there are no other questions, we'll Senate File 2494 will be laid over until we have a quorum.
That'd be
we'll
fine.
Take a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senate File 2185 and 2286. Senator Olsen.
Sit by me.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm before you today on Bill Senate File 22. Whoops. Senate File 2185, and that has to do with the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer, which has become a big part of my life in the last year and a half. There's a power plant proposal in my district, and the original proposal, they were going to tap into the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer and pull up possibly 2 million gallons a day for once through cooling water. And that was not, I don't think there was anybody that really liked that idea for obvious reasons. And as the project developed, we had gotten them a personal property tax exemption. And part of the exemption was a developer's agreement that the township and the county had to sign on to. And through that process, going into the aquifer was eliminated, so they are no longer proposing going into the aquifer. They had to redesign the plant to meet that accommodation of using less water, and they did that. They're also doing zero discharge into the Sunrise River, which where they were going to discharge the coolant water. And then they've also said that they are going to use gray water from the wastewater treatment plant in the area to use their cooling water. So this developer's agreement has really moved this thing forward. But the concern was so great that we developed a bill that originally was going to just include, there's a law right now that you can't pull Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer water out of the seven-county metropolitan area for anything but potable use. And so we, Representative Kayla and I, were going to extend that just to Chisago County. But I think it's a big enough issue. In our current issue of Government Magazine, there's a big story about water wars, and I think water is going to be one of our next oil resource-type resources. And so we felt that we want to move this throughout the state for the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer. Now, the bill that's before you, we're working on an amendment with the DNR. They had some concerns. And I also have a map, if I could have that passed out, which shows where the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer is. And it encompasses much of southeastern Minnesota. So I don't really have the language yet, if that's a problem. But basically what we want to do is delete Section B of the bill, because that's no longer a valid point if we do the ban throughout the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer. And then the DNR is saying that up to 100 million gallons a year for like agricultural uses and like an ethanol plant and those kinds of uses. So we didn't want to totally shut the aquifer down, but I think it's important that we really watch how much water we're pulling out of this aquifer. Let's see. I think the DNR guys who might speak to this are out in the hall right now working on the language. So if there's any questions, I can certainly stand for them if that's appropriate.
Senator Olstein, does this bill apply to a particular project that's going on now still, or does... Are you saying that that's not relevant anymore, that was just background?
Mr. Chair, correct. The power plant proposal is not going into the aquifer, but we felt that...
it was a good idea anyway to do this.
Yes.
And then what does your bill in its current form do?
In the current form, it would... It would virtually ban anything other than domestic potable water for like a city's municipal water system. It would ban any other usage, agricultural, for an ethanol plant. Any other kind of water from the Mount Simon would not be allowed. So in meeting with the DNR water folks, that's too restrictive. So they have just handed me some language that... would address that concern.
Is that ready to be passed out?
Mr. Chair, it's drafted in one. I just have a... I wonder if we could get a copy quickly, or if I should... Oh, you have it?
We have copies to pass out.
Mr. Chair, this one was just handed to me about 2 seconds ago.
Does he need somebody to move
So
it?
This is different than the one that was drafted here.
Let's pass it out, see what we got.
Okay.
Senator, do you have witnesses for on behalf of your original bill or any amendment?
I do.
That you'd like to speak first?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And that we have some folks from the DNR that... Is Jim available?
There.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we deal with the amendment, even though it could be considered an author's amendment, let's hear a little bit more about the issue. Up from the committee, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Lockesmo, Director of Waters for DNR. And we look at this bill and thought that it could be improved if it had some threshold in there, because there are a number of smaller projects that occur around in this area of the state. You got the map that shows the Mount Simon Hinckley. It extends basically from Duluth down to the southern border. And we didn't want to restrict projects that would have no adverse impact on the aquifer. So we proposed that there be a threshold established of 100 million gallons a year or something similar, that projects smaller than that would not be subject to this prohibition.
You said 100 million?
Yeah.
100 million.
Senator, Mr. Lockesmo, on the A1 amendment, is that supposed to say 100,000 gallons?
100 million.
Okay, so that is an error. It should have 3 more zeros?
Correct, Mr. Chair. That's
okay, that makes a big difference.
It certainly does. And I'm bringing in the war out of world.
So then, if we adopted this amendment, what would the bill do? Mr. Lockesmo?
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill would require large. This bill would then restrict appropriations that exceeded 100 million gallons annually to only be those that meet the criteria that are in Part A, which is for the potable water use, that there are no other alternatives. Mr. Chairman, when this bill came about, it was after the 1988 drought, the 89 Groundwater Act, and there for the metropolitan area, there was a desire to protect the Mount Simon Hinckley, which is the lower aquifer as you go through the layer cake of aquifers in the metro area. So this was to protect that aquifer as the savings account, if you will, for municipal water supply. But aquifers aren't uniformly distributed across the state. So as you go further north and for some of the areas on the western edge, the only aquifer, if you started drilling, the first aquifer you hit would be the Mount Simon Hinckley. So there may not be other alternatives for those users. And we want to make sure that we aren't restricting use when there aren't any other alternatives to the Mount Simon Hinckley.
The bill seeks to prohibit the issuance of water use permits in this aquifer. Unless it's over, unless it's under 100 million gallons. So if it's over 100 million gallons, then you can do it. You can issue a permit for that project.
No, Mr. Chairman. If it's under 100 million gallons, there is no restrictions. If the appropriation, proposed use is over 100 million gallons, then the restrictions that are contained in this statute apply, being only for potable water use. There aren't any feasible or practical alternatives, and a water conservation plan is incorporated in the permit. If those criteria are met, then we could issue a permit.
What projects would be encompassed in the over 100 million gallon range?
Other than municipal water use, it would be large water users, an ethanol plant, for example. A 100 million gallon capacity ethanol plant would use about 400 million gallons of water a year. So it would be a large use like that. There may be some industrial uses, but when we looked at the number of permits that exist in the Mount Simon Hinckley, for the ones that we have in our database, the large users were predominantly municipalities. I mean, there are some other this applies to new permits, not the, it doesn't take off the existing permits out of using water. The other large users were Flint Hills plant, the Waldorf Corporation used, well, that's in Ramsey County, though some of these on this list were also in Ramsey County, are in the metropolitan area.
What's the measurable change in policy with this bill after this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the change in policy would be that Mount Simon uses outside, large Mount Simon uses outside of the metropolitan counties would be restricted, other than municipal. And you aren't going to have new municipalities. All of those municipalities have existing permits. So any new activity would be a new industry of some type or a new large water user of some type.
What I'm hearing is that this isn't going to affect many projects.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's true. There could be some, but I don't have a crystal ball of how many there may be, or you'll see more ethanol plants and that type of in this area of the state.
How did you arrive at the $100 million threshold? Excuse me, 100 million gallon threshold?
Mr. Chairman, it was a nice round number. 100 million is not, when you're looking at water use, that's not a significant water use. When you're spreading it across 365 days for an average annual or average daily use. And what we didn't want to get into were an irrigation center pivot, for example, uses about 40 million gallons a year. We don't want to restrict that if there's a new proposal to irrigate. So those numbers all varied underneath 100 million.
Joel Seen, is this, with this amendment, is this bill doing what you're hoping it would?
Well, Mr. Chair, we originally were at a full band, and I believe that might have been too severe. But what I'm hoping to find is a balance between protecting this aquifer and then meeting the demand for the water. And at 100 million a year, that's probably about 2.5 million a day. And you know, if you can envision that, that's a lot of water, any way you look at it. And you think of the Mount Simon, some of that water may have taken 1,000 years to get there. And so that's what we're dealing with. You know, how do we protect that aquifer? So is that, I would have maybe liked to start with a smaller number, but I think that in reality that's probably a pretty accurate number.
Senator Anderson, then Pariseau and Fredrickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to put this in perspective, so maybe, Mr. Lacismo, you can tell us how, you know, what is the permitted use from this aquifer now in terms of hundreds of millions of gallons, and how much do all those little permits add up to per year, and what's the recharge rate in this aquifer? Do we have any of that information so we can sort of evaluate what is 100 million look like?
Mr. Lacismo.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I don't have that information at my fingertips. We can compute that. Now, there's a number of typically the aquifer of choice in the metropolitan area is the Jordan aquifer. It's above that. You don't have to drill down as far. It's not as expensive to extract water. But we can get the get those numbers for the committee, but I don't believe
I have them.
Well, Mr. Chair, can you give me some kind of a ballpark about, you know, because otherwise we're just, you know, we're just picking numbers out of thin air without that sort of context. I mean, you're picking numbers out, hopefully not out of thin air, but we're just counting on your advice that it's a nice round number. But, I mean, how does, and I guess looking at the current law, maybe just focus on the metropolitan counties versus outside the metropolitan area, if you know what the usage is of this aquifer now, just roughly?
Mr. Chair, and,
annually?
Senator Anderson, the use, and I don't have copies of this, but this map shows the distribution of use of this aquifer, and the size of the circle shows the quantity of appropriation. So the bulk of this appropriation is from the seven-county metropolitan area. There is some, you know, scattered in other areas of the state. The number of permittees that we have that are drawing water out of the Mount Simon, 264 current users out of that Mount Simon. And most of the large users are municipalities. Fridley, for example, takes
2.4 million.
That's $2.4 billion a
gallons.
Gallons.
Billion?
A year.
Billions with a B.
We're a thirsty lot in Fridley.
Well hydrated.
Not a dry colony.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you're drinking your water.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's good stuff, too, that aquifer. But,
sorry to interrupt, Mr. Locke.
So, but in the metropolitan counties, under the current law, the municipalities can only take that for drinking water purposes, correct? So those billions that you're talking about are limited to drinking water usage?
And, I think Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, that is correct. And I was just handed a sheet that shows the actual gallons used in the Mount Simon Hinckley for the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And it is a little under, it's probably about 14 billion gallons a year. And you'll see the use is maintained relatively constant from this chart from 1988 through 2003.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just try to get a glimmer of information about the recharge and what's happening to the aquifer. Do we know the condition of the water? Is it tested for contamination? And what are its levels looking like?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, the water is, you know, certainly all of the municipal users are testing their water on a
sure
daily basis, so it is tested. The water in the Mount Simon Hinckley is relatively old water, and we do test that as, and it takes a long time to for this water, for any new water to get into the system. It is, you know, it's probably 1,000 years old, as Senator Olsen said, and I'm sure it's tested older than that in some areas. You know, there is recharge that occurs. The recharge, if you look at the map that is handed out, occurs out on the western edge mostly, where the aquifer gets closer to the surface, and that's the general recharge area, is the darker shaded area of this map. There is leakage between the aquifers, some, and that occurs. But this aquifer would recharge slowly. We've just completed a synoptic water level measurement of the aquifers in the Twin Cities area. And, you know, the deeper aquifers are maintaining their levels better. You aren't seeing the impacts, although you see seasonal impacts from summer lawn watering is our largest use, in, and you'll see impacts, temporary drawdowns. And then it rebounds when the appropriations slow.
Mr. Chair, can I please follow up? Thank you for. I still don't quite understand one thing, and that is, I thought under the current law that the municipalities could only take that aquifer for drinking water purposes. Can they take it from the aquifer and use it for drinking water and for watering our lawns and golf courses and all that?
Mr. Lockesbaum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, they're taking it for municipal use, and the municipal system is providing water for multiple features, including some irrigation.
On that point, Senator Frederickson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson brought up the point that I was questioning about. When you say drinking water, and it's a municipal system, it'd be used for golf courses, lawns, including industrial use, I assume. If there's an industry within the city limits and they're getting city water, they would be using this water in industry.
So, Mr. Chair, if there was a large industrial user that was going to put some water fountains in their facility, would that qualify under this language as potable water uses?
Mr. Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, there's, you know, that's probably some of the gray area in the, you know, the water is certainly extracted and treatable, so it's available for potable use. The there are uses that end up being where water is used for something where you wouldn't need potable treated water, but we do have a system where you know all the lawn watering that occurs is with treated water, and we haven't built dual systems, and that probably won't occur because of expense.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I need to give. Senator Parasol has had her hand up for a while. I'll get to you, Senator. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lacasmo, I'd like to know if you could share a bit with this committee what kind of restrictions there currently are on irrigators and if there are any further restrictions coming down the pike for irrigators and what they might be.
Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Parasol, you know, anyone that uses more than a million gallons of water a year needs an appropriation permit. And like I said, a center pivot irrigation system is about 40 million gallons a year. So they need to get a permit. And we evaluate those based on the potential impact to adjacent users. So if there's an impact, that needs to be resolved. And one of the impacts that we have seen is you may have a high-capacity irrigation system may affect an adjacent domestic well, and then that has to be resolved, and we have a process set up to provide resolution to that. So that's as far as any other restrict. There's not really a restriction on that. We have to evaluate each application based on whether or not there's enough water in the system at that point that you aren't adversely impacting higher priority users.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who can answer this question, but Senator Olsen, you talked about it when you gave your presentation about the gray water, recycling water. Can you talk a little more about how much of that would be available? Is that something that's growing? I mean, usage of, I know some of the ethanol plants, I think, were using some recyclable water, and that's, you know, just in the last couple of years, I know they've been talking about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think when we talk about water wars and our future in water, the gray water is going to be a big market. Actually, LS Power, who's developing this power plant, has negotiated to purchase the gray water from the Chisago County Wastewater or Joint Wastewater Treatment Plant, and they estimate they will be able to use 1.1 million gallons a day from that plant. And then they'll have that in a reservoir that will feed into the cooling system for the power plant. So they're purchasing that gray water. And if I may, Mr. Chair, by preventing that water from going into the Sunrise River and thus down to the St. Croix and just down to Lake Pepin, they're preventing minerals and salts that will be that would have gone down the river. Now, as part of their developer's agreement, they're going to put in a filtering system that will pull those trace minerals out of the water, and then they will also be able to recycle the recycled water so they can use it again through the cooling system. So I see this, when you say ethanol plants are using this, I think there's been a number of stories in the news recently about how this is kind of the new thing, and I think it's a very good new thing because if we can use this gray water for recycling it again, I think it's just we're not pulling water out of the aquifer to do other jobs, especially for cooling. So I think we're on a new trend doing that more, and I think it's a very positive thing for our aquifers.
Senator Phoebe.
Mr. Chair, my question has been answered. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
questions?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lacasmo, can you clarify for me in this earlier discussion with Senator Anderson about the water use permit, if a municipality has a water system, are they the ones that get the water use permit, or do their users that would use a various quantity and be starting up, would they have to have a separate permit through you rather than just the municipality?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the municipality obtains the permit.
So that's if the municipality had a water use permit prior and or had put the well in prior to this law, then they wouldn't have to comply essentially with this, because I mean you've got a mixed, you obviously a municipal system has got a mixed use. There people are going to take baths and wash dishes and do all kinds of things besides drinking water. It would be pretty hard to separate that. But it's a municipality that has, if they were going to drill a new well and go into this aquifer, they would have to have a special permit and waiver of some of these requirements.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if a municipality was going to drill a new permit into this aquifer, they would have to meet the requirements that have been specified. And some have done that. Looking at potable water use, no feasible or practical alternatives, and that they have a conservation plan, so they're not wasting water. So if they meet those criteria, then we would amend their permit and incorporate this new well into that system. Where there's been a conflict has been, or some concern, is if you go to Forest Lake, for example, there's not as many aquifers or as good a choices. So they like to go to the Mount Simon Hinckley first, and maybe that's not the best choice. So we work through those issues with each municipality.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chairman. Sir Loxmo, once upon a time I did know the names of the different aquifers in the various layers. The Mount Simon Hinckley is one of the deepest ones, is it not? Can you name the other ones? See if I can refresh my memory.
Lacasmo.
Mr. I'm Chairman and Senator Olson.
Teacher,
well, the primary one in the metropolitan area is the Jordan aquifer.
Yeah, Jordan.
And the deepest, you are correct, the deepest one is the Mount Simon Hinckley. There are a couple others in there, the Ironton, Galesville, the Franconia, which have less capacity and aren't as thick. And typically, some of those are used, but not as often. The two primary ones in the metropolitan area are the Prairie du Chien Jordan and then the Mount Simon Hinckley.
Okay. Thank you.
And they are changing names of these, I think, as the geologists get into this, so you'll be confused later.
Senator Fredrickson Scogan, then we have a witness who has requested to testify.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lacasmo, if under this amendment a 100 million gallon permit would be granted, what would the permit cost be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, the application cost for permit is $150, but the reason I hesitate here is that there is a law that requires us to recover the full costs of processing a permit if they're for more than 100 million gallons a year. And so it depends, and some of those costs, for example, for ethanol in the last few years, have ranged in the $10,000 plus, because they've had, and these are in western Minnesota, not necessarily with the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer. But if there is the potential for conflicts, then we had to have pumping tests, we had to do a lot of other work. But the basic application fee is the $150. But we are required to recover full cost if it's more than 100 million a year, and that's something that depends on the complexity of the specific application.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lacasmo, so above that application permit, there is no charge for the water once that's in place. There's no yearly charge for using that resource.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, there is a yearly charge, a water use fee, that's charged to each permittee. And it's set statutorily, and it varies based on volume. And it's about $7 a million at that rate.
Thank you.
Actually, I think that's a little high.
Does this bill just apply to the state permit?
Uh, Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe so.
There may be other permits to be had?
Mr. Chairman, not other water use permits. This section of law, 103G271, is the section that deals with DNR water use permits.
What if the watershed district wants to weigh in?
Mr. Chairman, the watershed district gets a copy of all of the permit applications we receive, and they provide comments based on their issues of concern.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Move to our witness.
And Senator Olsen, in this, I think the chair maybe started to ask my question. When I look at the aquifer, and I understand your intent to protect other units of government, county, township, municipalities, or have you had that conversation and reached some kind of an agreement that this is the road you want to go down?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, you'll look at that map that there's a straight line across the bottom and kind of a curvy line on the eastern side. Those are states that we don't have any jurisdiction over, so anything we do to this would truly be in a portion of the aquifer that's in Minnesota, obviously, but as far as having conversations with cities and other users, no. Our experience with this power plant and the negative feedback that it generated, it's a very intense issue when, especially, if I may, in the lakes area, the Chisago Lakes area, their water levels are down about 5 feet. And so people that used to have a 20-foot beach now have a 120-foot beach. And there is really probably not a connection between the Mount Simon because it's 600 feet below them and this surface water. But, boy, oh, boy, you start talking about their water, and it gets very, very passionate very quickly. So we have not actually did as you said, but I have talked to League of Minnesota Cities a little bit. But
okay.
Mr. Johnson.
Speaking of,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the wonderful transition and introduction. My name is Craig Johnson. I am with the League of Minnesota Cities. We have been talking very briefly with the author to work on some language with this. A couple of things to point out in the bill is that there already is in the metropolitan area a prohibition on the use of the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer unless it is essentially unavoidable and for a very high level of use. Potable water, no other feasible alternative. We've been working very hard for quite a long time now to protect that deep aquifer for future needs because we have very high water needs in a quickly growing metropolitan area. So one of the reasons the senator got language handed to him on the fly while he was trying to present his bill is because the 100 million gallon exemption that is being discussed, if we just apply it to the existing language and remove the link to the metropolitan area that is in the current language, it means that even in the metropolitan area, a use of 100 million gallons per day or less could be taken from the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer. Right now, that is not the case. So what we are working on is a tweak to the amendment that you have in front of you that would instead leave the current protections on the seven-county metro area and say that the 100 million gallon per day exemption would be on areas outside that that meet the same kind of requirements, that they don't have another option. They need to be using that aquifer.
As one committee member, Mr. Johnson, I'd like any more explanation, if it exists, as to why that the particular threshold has been determined. It's arbitrary. Okay, I appreciate that, but if it is arbitrary, I think this is an important enough issue where we should have some, at least some science behind what the appropriate level it should be. Is it too high, too much? I don't know. But what we would be doing is setting a policy saying that that threshold is okay. And as just one member of the committee, I've become a little uncomfortable explaining that, if should I be asked, why did you set it this mark? Don't know. particularly since it's we're setting a statewide policy saying that this threshold is okay, but others are not. So I want to that's important to me, Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the testimony by Mr. Johnson. Although I believe, if counsel could straighten me out on this, I think the language before us in the amendment actually would address the metropolitan area.
Senator Olson first.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was trying to understand where I don't see anything about 100 million gallons. That in the amendment? Are you referring to this amendment before us?
Senator Olson, in the A1, there's a typo. It should say 100 million.
Rather than 100,000.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson, I think I'm at the point where I think we need to lay the bill over and we need to take some time to work on it.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. This one is deeper in the weeds than I thought it was going to go. So although that 100,000 might be a good number to leave in there.
Let me just say finally, Senator Olson, that I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish with this bill.
And we'll work on refining it. And
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reemphasize the point that you made. Or maybe it's a request to Mr. Lacasmo, and that is help us understand 100 million gallons. Sounds like a lot to me, but I have no idea. It's like when we're dealing with pollution and, you know, we're dealing with tons or tiny bits, and it's hard to really get our arms around what that really means. So some way to help us understand illustrative. I mean, you said Fridley uses like a billion some gallons. That sounds like a lot to me, too. And so I just need to understand better what 100 million gallons
Mr. Chair,
is.
If I may, a lot of the tank farms that you see that store petroleum products are about a 10 million gallon tank. So 10 of those would be a million or 100 million. So
that's helpful. Thank you.
Senate File 2185 is laid over.
Okay.
Senator Anderson, then we'll take up 2286.
Thank you. I appreciate that because I know you're laying the bill over. I just wanted to follow up and say as well that I think we need to have a longer-term vision of what is a sustainable use of our aquifers, and we don't really have that to measure these things against. We don't know what we've got, and we don't know how much we should be able to use, and that would help us guide us in figuring out what alternatives might be available and affordable in the long run. So we're working on that sustainable water framework, and I hope that will give us some answers. But I think over the long run that we really need that to help guide these kinds of decisions.
Quick question, Mr. Lacasmo. Does the DNR and the PCA both have jurisdiction over the Groundwater Protection Act?
Mr. Chairman, yes, over different parts.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Senate File 2286. Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm here today on 2286, which is a bill that talks about recycling construction and demolition waste from state projects, and it requires that the demolition material from projects of over $5 million state projects be sent to a landfill that recycles 50% of the material. So this bill is in an effort to try to cut down on the waste going into our landfills, and I do have an amendment also.
Okay, we'll pass that out.
Just going to leave it on the highways for now.
I have the A1 amendment, and this amendment simply it puts some restrictions that a facility has to be within 40 miles of the project, so that if it were an outstate project and there was not a recycling waste facility within 40 miles, they wouldn't have to follow through with that. A large outstate project, it would be kind of hard on them to have to send materials 100 miles. I mean, then you're losing any cost benefit of it. But I do have a handout that really addresses some of the dollar amounts saved. Is that there's quite a few, thank you, there's quite a large savings by being able to recycle the materials versus just sending them to a landfill. So in some typical projects, they were saving probably almost 75% of the cost of the waste demolition by recycling it. So maybe dropping it from $125,000 to $25,000 to dispose of the waste material. So that's basically the bill in a nutshell.
Senator Anderson moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill into the shape the author prefers. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment adopted. Senator Olsen, you have any witnesses?
I if there's any specific questions, I do have somebody who's in the recycling business that would be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I read your bill over when I came to my office and you asked me to sign on as a co-author, and it just seemed to, on the surface, that it's kind of hard to mandate this because in my own mind, I was just thinking there must be all kinds of different types of renovation projects and construction projects, and buildings are being painted and windows are being replaced and so on, and to require that 50% of the construction and demolition waste would have to be recycled. I just by instinct was that it just maybe it was not appropriate to apply that as a blanket across the whole range of different construction projects. And I'm just wondering where this idea came from, how much it was researched ahead of time, and who's supporting it and who's opposing it.
Earl Olsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I appreciate the question. You know, a lot of projects, like a paving project, it's real easy to recycle, especially, you know, concrete can be chopped up and you can reuse it, and asphalt can be chopped up and reuse it. So in those instances, it's very easy to recycle. But we do have in the bill that it's for projects of over $5 million. So they're fairly substantial projects. And so it's not just simply replacing a few windows, or it would be a lot of windows at $5 million. So it's towards bigger projects that would produce more waste. There are a number of states like Massachusetts and Wisconsin that are already, they've done this for quite a while. And in Wisconsin, I believe it started in 1996 with help from the state, and then it's turned into a self-funding organization called, I believe it's Cap Watch, or Waste Cap. And they're able to recycle a lot of material, and there again the goal on this is to prevent material from ending up in the landfill if we can use it for other things.
Senator Olsen.
But I didn't get my question answered. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, who is supporting it and who is opposing it?
Well, I would say that Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I think the supporters are people, of course, that are interested in recycling material, and people that operate construction yards that recycle material. I mean, that's a big part of their business. But so I would say people, I haven't had any opposition, but I didn't have any opposition to my water bill till about 3 hours ago either. So.
I should mention that this is a proposal that is in the House bonding bill as well, for what it's worth. Okay, Senator Dill.
Well, I have one other question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, and that is it currently a problem that we're not recycling enough, and that's why you've got this requirement that you want to put into state law?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I think there's an opportunity for the state to take a leadership role in this, and that's these are on state facilities, and if we set the example and kind of set the bar that, you know, we recognize that there's valuable material from demolition, and if we can extract those materials, whether it's wood to go to an RFD plant or something like that, we're kind of leading. Because the other thing is, these things just go in the landfill, and I think that's what we want to prevent.
But, Mr. Chairman, I still didn't quite get the question answered. The question answered, is there a problem? What evidence do you have that there's a problem right now that we're not recycling enough?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that question because I just went to the east. In our five-county area, there's a East County East County Central Solid Waste Commission, and they operate a landfill. And they may not be able to get a permit extension for expanding their waste facility. They're sure hoping they will, but they're filling up, and part of that is materials that could be used for something else or used in another way because they're filling up the landfill. So there is a problem, I think, with our landfills filling up, and if we can prevent materials from going in the landfill, I think that benefits everybody. I hope that's a good enough answer.
I had Olson, Fredrickson, and then Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my question is somewhat like Senator Dill's last question as to whether this is a problem, because it seems to me the economics of it have been driving a fair amount of this recycling now. The costs of dumping into a landfill are not cheap. And I know a number of years ago I had a barn taken down that was concrete and there was steel in it, and they separated that. It was just a single, you know, an independent operator guy that took it down, but all of the concrete was hauled to a place where they grind that up, and the steel went to another place, and we did our own resource recovery with the wood, but that it was far more than 50% that got recycled. And I think a lot of this is happening by virtue of the fact that these processes are available. And I just wonder why we need a law that when I think the economics are such that they would drive this kind of behavior. And for especially the big kind of construction companies that would be dealing with state facilities, do we know of any state facility that has been of this volume where that has happened, that everything got hauled to a landfill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'll try to take your questions in order here. In my real-world job, I oftentimes drive a semi around, and I was hauling into downtown Minneapolis to a large retail store that was remodeling, and they had probably a 10-yard dumpster. They were just throwing steel shelves in there like you wouldn't believe. And that's very easy to recycle steel, but that was just going in a dumpster. And so I think there needs to be an opportunity for the state to demonstrate that these materials can be recycled, and on these larger projects where there's really an economic savings to it. As you said, I think when it's your own barn, or I've torn buildings down myself, and but I think on a construction project, they're more in the attitude, you know, rip that wall out and throw it in the dumpster. I honestly think that's the mentality that I see in a lot of construction projects that I'm around.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Olson, Senator Olson, you don't think that somebody, whoever the company is that's got the dumpster, might drive by a steel place that's got a magnet that would just kind of suck that stuff right out of there? Rather than, and you know, actually get some money for it, rather than haul it to pay to haul it to a dump. I mean, something's missing here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rolls, I think it's a convenience factor, and because that was mixed waste, that wasn't just steel they were throwing in this dumpster. They were throwing garbage and construction debris in there. So I think in a situation like that, no, they're not doing that. And I would like to see us move to a point where we do separate that. And so this bill simply says that on state projects of over $5 million, that the waste materials will go to a center that will recycle has an average recycle rate of 50% of the materials, so that they will be recycled.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm struggling with what is meant in the last few lines, the requirements for the recycling. Is this a two-step provision where, first of all, to require the recycling, it'd have to be a contract of $5 million or more, and within 40 miles of a recycling facility? What would happen for a project lower than $5 million in cost?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, they would be exempt from this requirement. I mean, I'd like them, it'd be nice if they did it, but they would be exempt.
Even if they're within 40 miles?
Even, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, even if they're within 40 miles of a recycling center, if there was a $1 million contract and they were 30 miles away, they would be exempt?
That's my interpretation, yes.
Oh, Senator, you got a follow-up?
No, I'm not. I was just going to say I'm going to think about that a little bit.
Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out some of the information that's sitting in front of us here just mentions, and I assume this is all from Wisconsin data. It says a study performed by the DNR, and that may have been the Wisconsin DNR, I'm not sure, found that construction and demolition material made up nearly 30% of the municipal solid waste stream. And so I've heard the question asked, what's the problem here we're trying to solve? And I think there's a big problem. And if it makes up that much of the waste stream, we should think about the fact that when we review our budget in the next week or so, we're going to see the costs that we all pay for those landfills. You know, that's a cost to taxpayers. That's an ongoing cost because they leak and they have to be, there's lots of costs associated with landfills. And if we can reduce the amount going into landfills, it'll save everyone money. And I think it's one of those sort of culture change things that construction companies are. I mean, if you've ever had anything work done at your house, I don't live out in the country and tear down barns myself, but I've had remodeling done at my house, and yeah, they pull up a dumpster and throw everything in, and it goes straight to the trash, and it's just what people are used to doing. And I think this is a good way to set an example using state-funded projects only. This is not a requirement on the private sector in general. This just says if you're going to use state bonding dollars and it's a big project, we should set a good example. And I think if it also says in this information that some of the contractors who started to follow these requirements realized they were saving money, and so they started to do it even when they weren't required to. And I think a lot of contractors just don't really think about the alternative because they haven't.
If it's the way he wants it.
It just hasn't occurred to them that they could save money by recycling these products. So I think it sets, it just puts a different way of doing things out there, and we'll set an example that maybe others would follow because it actually is a money-saving proposition.
Senator Kilosh.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, being from the construction industry, I know that a lot of the major contractors are already doing this in any big site, and they're sorting the cardboard, the steel, the concrete, all of that, just because it saves them money both on the dumping costs, but it also earns them a little money in the recycling, and it helps with LEED certification. So those are a combination of things. And to address one of the things that's becoming more and more difficult is finding landfill sites and filling them up with recyclable material is just not a good idea if we can do something different. And we're essentially trying to keep money from being deposited in a landfill because it's worth something. So, if it sets an example, one of the things that we also have to remember that, we build buildings all over the state, and where in the metro area it's convenient to do recycling because there's more entities to deposit that, drop that off, and somebody else does the cleanup on it, etc. In outstate Minnesota, it'll be a little bit more difficult. So that's why I appreciate the 40 miles and even the $5 million. But if we can change the mindset a little bit to make recycling in demolition of state buildings part of the contract, I think it's a good idea that will help generate more. You'll find that contractors that weren't doing the recycling, when they started recycling, they suddenly found out how much money they saved, and it became much more profitable for them to do the job. So I think this is a good bill, and I think the corrections we made are good. So,
Senator Olson, and then we've got a witness.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I know that a lot of the dumpsters that are taken to construction sites, the companies take them to the special places for construction and demolition debris, not to regular landfills. Mm-hmm. And at those places, they do separate and do that, and they want that separate because I think it's cheaper for them to take them there than it is to the ordinary landfill. That's why I'm wondering, I don't know if it was correct to assume that if you have remodeling done, that the dumpster that was left there is automatically going to go to a mixed municipal waste solid waste landfill. The other question I have is, how do you implement this, and is there going to be an agency that's going to want to add personnel to be able to monitor the projects and a whole reporting requirement and all of that kind of stuff that goes with this? We don't stop to think of that, and that's part of the challenge we're facing in state government, is that every law that we pass seems to generate some further expenditure. And I just keep reflecting back to when I worked for the state, and five departments were in the Centennial Building. I was in Department of Education, and that was the fourth floor of the Centennial Building, and that governed was over all of the K-12 schools, the area of vocational technical institutes, did the workforce development training. All of that was handled by personnel in that one story. And welfare was fifth floor, conservation was third floor, taxes was second floor, and I think it was I can't remember what first floor was. But now every one of those departments has huge buildings filled with people and plus a bunch of other departments. And we wonder, I'm not against, state employees, but those have all been caused by things that we do. And I think we should think about that, too, because at the same time we're going to try to cut things. I hope we're not adding something that's going to require personnel or keep people from doing other things that we think are essential in order to carry it out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rolson, I just toured the Centennial Building. I think the fifth floor is now a data center. So,
A data center.
But to answer your question, I believe that, if this becomes law, it'll just be in the bid specs that, you have to recycle the waste. The demo from this project has to go to a recycling center that will recycle 50% of the waste. And so that'll be in the bid. And then whether it's construction management or there's a superintendent on the job site, I believe Senator Kelash would probably be better to answer this, but I don't think we have to build a multitude layer of bureaucracy to follow through. I think it would just become part of the bid specs.
Mr. Waslowski.
Mr. Chair, can I add to that? One of the things that this, the way the bill is written, is that it's as part of the contracts that will be going out for state projects. And one of the advantages of that, those folks that are overseeing the project as the quality of the construction and everything else can also monitor this at the same time. So you really don't need anyone extra. And it's incorporated in the contract. So I think it's just an easy, simple way of doing it that promotes the use of keeping out of the landfills.
So. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Waslowski. I'm the Director for Real Estate and Construction Services within the Department of Administration. And I'd first like to just mention that we already, in our Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines, we have a goal of recycling 75% of all construction debris within and waste within our new construction and major
renovation.
Could
you pull the mic closer to you? Thank you.
Sorry, Madam Chair. We already have the goal of 75% recycling. That is a goal, and I think you've hit on some of the key variables that impact the economics and cost here. Mileage is certainly a critical item. Obviously, the market conditions, the market's changes for these recycling materials, it's not a static thing, so that market is moving up and down depending on what type of construction debris you're talking about. The other piece is whether or not it contains any hazardous materials. And I would like to go in that direction a little bit. This language is a little bit different than what's in the House bonding bill. In the House bonding bill, we were able to get inserted non-hazardous waste. And many times when we're dealing with demolition projects or even renovation projects, we have asbestos-containing material or lead-based paint that's been applied to a construction material. If you were required to recycle that, then you're first going to have to abate it before you can recycle it, and that'd be at a significant cost to the state. The other piece that I just comment on the mileage condition, right now we have that, as I'm reading that provision, it's only applying to the demolition projects. I think it would also apply to the new construction and renovation projects as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And by the way, I would agree related to the administration of this, how we're currently handling it, is we just simply put a requirement in our bid documents on whatever threshold we think can be achieved. We recently did a demolition project this past year in the right on Capitol campus. It was the church facility that we acquired next to the Stassen building, which was a fairly significant building. And in that case, we were able to achieve 95% recycling of materials. And that had to do with a lot of the concrete was ground up right on site and reused right on site. So it does vary from project to project a great deal. But I would say this, all agencies, I think, share the goal that is expressed in this provision.
Mr. Wasilowski, do you know how much of our municipal solid waste stream is made up of construction and demolition material?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Would you venture to guess we are comparable to the 30% in Wisconsin?
Mr. Chair, I really don't know.
And then are you familiar with the Wisconsin pilot project and had a nonprofit group involved and almost three agencies?
There we go.
Mr. Chair, I actually just received that information from Representative Gardner, who we'd been working with on the modifications to the language on the House side. And he forwarded it. So we are now, but I wasn't before.
Your goal is 75%, and then in some cases you're reaching 90% and more. What would be the problem with Senator Olsen's bill if it included the non-hazardous exception?
Mr. Chair, the only concern I would have would be related to the mileage issue and having that apply to all projects, not just demolition projects. You could, right now as it's written, you have construction and renovation projects of $5 million or more. You could have a $10 million construction project that's in Ely that is 100 miles away from a recycling facility, and you could come into significant cost impacts. That mileage is a critical factor in the economics.
You would remove that or you'd change it?
I would simply change it so that the 40-mile provision applies to construction and renovation as well as demolition. So that if you're greater than 40 miles, this requirement would not apply.
Okay. And insert the non-hazardous.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a clarification. If the Department of Administration has this goal, do you use, do you put any requirements into the specifications for projects that are being done? It sounds like you're applying that across the board to all projects, never mind the limitation. And I wonder, I'll take the reverse here, is what does this add to what, would this bill aid in another, or is it redundant in relation to what you're already doing?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would be speaking for my small group of the world here on bonding projects. Obviously, the bonding projects that get funded here go way beyond the Department of Administration, so I really can only speak to admin's piece of it. We're already including a recycling requirement in our construction contracts. I guess I don't see that it doesn't hurt to have it in statute as well to be able to cite a statute in the spec, add some weight. I guess that contractors know that we're very serious about doing this.
So I like a minimum requirement, and you can start with a goal, and I understand where you're coming from, but a requirement is better than a goal. Okay, Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate now, I'd like to offer an amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, my attempt is to more simply state what it is that you want to happen without the numbered clauses. So I would move on line 12, delete one paren, construction and renovation, and at the end of line 12, delete and. And line 13, delete everything before located. So that sentence would read, this requirement applies to state building projects receiving funding from the bond proceeds fund after January 1, 2010 as follows. Projects of $5 million or more located within 40 miles of a recycling facility that handles the applicable building materials.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Senator Fredericks. And if I read that right, though, then we take the demolition projects out. So I support what you're doing there. I just want to be able to include the construction, renovation, and the demolition. So,
you know, it's
Mr.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think they would be covered because we say for the construction, renovation, or demolition up on lines 5 and 6.
Mr. Chair, on that point,
Senator Anderson,
is your intention that demolition projects under $5 million would be covered because they tend to be less costly? Is that the difference?
The demolition, well,
yeah.
Because the demolition is mainly, I believe, for, you know, like a in a renovation project, there will be
some demolition.
You know, so that brings up a good point, Senator Anderson. But I think it's important, Mr. Chair, if we could keep demolition in there.
Well, yes, Senator Olsen, I think Senator Fredrickson is making that grammatical change. I don't think it's meant to exclude demolition.
It's not necessary to restate them in this phrase.
He's just taking the redundancy out of that phrase.
Construction, renovation, and demolition.
But it's already we're already talking about all that in
the whole section refers to construction demolition in the section title as well as the first sentence.
Okay.
In regards to construction, renovation, or demolition.
Mr. Chair,
true.
I always rely on Senator Olson for this kind of stuff. She's kind of my word police person, so.
Senator Fredrickson's pretty good, too.
Okay.
Mr. Wozlowski?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify, does that still, the 40-mile limit would then still apply to the to demolition as well?
So it would not does not address your concern necessarily in this amendment. Is that right, Senator Fredrickson, or does it?
I think it would.
Or would?
It does.
Okay. Then are all seen in stump.
Mr. Chair, whatever appropriate point non-hazardous we would be in, I would like that in.
Okay.
Also,
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen. Do you have a definition, or somebody has a definition of a state building?
Mr. Knopf?
I didn't hear the question.
Is there a definition of state building?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Administration governs all state buildings. I don't know if they have an actual definition of state building in their chapter. I'd have to look. But it is basically whatever is administered by the Department of Administration, whatever building they administer, the actual building of the building and the servicing of the building and that sort of thing.
Maybe state and local government, which is a committee that this needs to go to next, could hash that out. That's a fair question. On the Fredrickson Amendment, everybody understand it? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. And then Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was thinking on line 7, before construction, you could insert non-hazardous. Would that work?
Mr. Wozlowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I was also thinking line 8, after demolition, it could go non-hazardous waste.
I think
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think your way is better, actually.
Which, either way.
I think it's better.
Senator Anderson moves that on line 7, before the word construction, insert non-hazardous. I don't know if that's one word or
one word.
A hyphenated word.
It's one word.
One word. Very good. No. Everybody understand that? See no further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2286. If not, Senator Anderson.
Oh, sure. I'd move
Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 2286, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Ah, yes. Senator Saxon.
Could I move Senate File 2494?
Please.
I move Senate File 2494 that it be passed and sent to the floor as Senator Stumpf has said he doesn't need it in his committee. Is that correct, Senator Stumpf?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Consent calendar? Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 2494 be recommended to pass and referred to the consent calendar. That sound like a good motion?
That does.
And this, members, this is the bill that we heard before we had a quorum present. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
While Senator Rosen is getting settled, I wanted to direct members' attention to a brochure and a letter on your desk. This is the a brochure from the Minnesota Legislative Sportsmen's Caucus, which is becoming more and more organized with every year. It has been recently been recognized by the National Association of Sportsmen Caucuses, as well as the Congressional Sportsman Foundation. And there's information on what it is about and information on how to join should you desire. There's a letter signed by myself, co-chair Representative Hoppe, and our executive committee. Many of them are members of this committee, Senator Saxog, Fulby, Ingebrigtsen, and then and three House members as well. So members can consider, if you would consider joining the Legislative Sportsman's Caucus, I'd really appreciate it. And a reminder that tonight is the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance's annual legislative banquet at the Holiday Inn on 94 McKnight Road. And if you have any questions about membership, you can certainly see me. Senator Rosen, Senate File 2268.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think this is going to be a fun bill. Not that your other ones were not fun, but this is probably deals with a sport that you all probably enjoy. I know you do, Mr. Chair, and myself. But this is basically 2268 is designating the Blue Earth River as a canoe and boating route designation. And the reason is this was actually brought up to me by a constituent. And back in 1983, there was a statewide outstanding rivers inventory, and you do have a handout from the Minnesota DNR stating the summary about that inventory. And there was all these rivers that were designated as canoe and boating routes, and the last one on the list is the first one on the list, but the last one to be designated is the Blue Earth River, and that goes right through my Senate district. And it's a beautiful river, and it's just perfect for canoeing and kayaking. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that hopefully you all have. It's the A-10-2078 amendment. It's a delete all. Does anybody have that?
Delete all. Mr. Chair, Marianne is going up to your office to get the copy of the amendment.
Making copies of it. Okay. Would you like to describe it?
Sure. Mr. Chair, it's just a very simple amendment. And this came from the DNR that they would like to, on lines 1.9, scratch new and boating and routes and put in state water trails. Because they are changing, they have a DNR water trails program, and that's another sheet that you should have as far as their program. And then also on line would be 1.16, after canoe, put in kayak, because kayak is getting to be one of the largest water sports in the state, and they want to recognize that. So those are just really the only two changes, and then along with adding the Blue Earth River designation on lines 1.14.
I was wondering why you didn't have kayak mentioned in there.
Well, Mr. Chair, you've seen my kayaks, and I understand you are proud owners now, too. So
so let me ask you
Mr.
this.
Chairman?
The first question I have, one second, Senator Perez. So
What is the implication of designating a river as a canoe and boating route or a water trail, as you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, we've had Eric Reed, and he is the DNR Water Trails Coordinator, come down to the river and look at the river, travel along it, and with that would come some appropriation out of the water recreation account of the Natural Resources Fund, and they could do boat landings, and they would put it on their maps as a water route designation. And frankly, it is a tourist attraction. A lot of that designation goes up north or maybe to the southeast corner of the state, but we do have some beautiful rivers. And as you can tell by the map, this is an area that it would just drop straight down actually from Mankato and go through Blue Earth County and Faribault County, and that would serve that area. So it is, there is the monies are there, $60,000, to get this accessible to canoers and kayakers. And then from there, the local jurisdictions would be able to utilize it for tourism.
Mr. Potter, can you expand on that as well? Welcome to the committee.
My name is Ron Potter. I'm with Parks and Trails. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen is correct. It's a marketing tool, but we also would put effort into maintaining a navigable channel to ensure that the people can get down there. We would provide public access. We also would try to find sites for campsites along the river as well. And then we would put that all on a map that the local communities could use for advertising that resource.
Okay. So,
And Mr. Chair,
well,
if I could.
There's a little bit of a special attention paid to that particular route in terms of accesses and then perhaps debris clearing, kind of like how you maintain a trail except on the water.
Mr. Chair,
so that someone doesn't have to go onto a river at random and not be sure what's there.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yes.
All right. Kind of like I did last summer. I ended up pushing over sandbars more than actual canoeing. Okay. And then are all of your maps now stating that they are state water trails? Has that conversion been made?
Mr. Chair, that has not occurred yet. This is a new change, and we would like to make that change. But right now in statute it still says canoe and boating, but if we can get this changed to water trails, yes, our new publications will all come out marketed as water trails. And that's consistent with the way that it's going in other states as well.
Mayor Parisel.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to at this time move the A-10 amendment.
Okay.
Be adopted.
Any other questions? The A-10 to get the shape in the author prefers it. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion. Mr. Potter, $60,000 from the water rec account, how much money is in there?
Mr. Chair, there's adequate funding in that account.
Yes. How much is in there?
I was just curious. Yeah, I guess he is. He's
a
trails coordinator. Oh, gosh.
He used the word. Ken says over a million. Dan says over a million.
I looked at his name. That's what I'm
saying. Mr. Chair, there's about $900,000 in there.
Okay. Just a quick question. We'll get into that more in the next committee, I guess. All right. Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Bill number. I would move that Senate File 2268 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. It's in order. Any further discussion? We will look for the invitations to canoe the new designated water trail.
Mr. There Chair, and then we can come over to my house or go to the best hamburger joint in southern Minnesota. Well, state
by
Minnesota,
water,
actually.
By water.
By water, that's right.
Or skis or whatever.
I would appreciate that.
Skis.
We have a field trip, Mr.
We've had some fun up north, but we're a little light on what we've done in southern Minnesota.
That's
so
right, exactly. That would be fun, I promise you.
Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senator Fredrickson.
Next item on the agenda is VHS and Asian carp update. Mr. Johannes, Mr. Skinner.
Is that it?
So did you get a real kayak?
My wife really wants, I think she's referring to my wife really wants.
You know, Greg's a big kayak.
My wife's my boat. I got mine out for fishing. I got rod covers.
That's what I like. That's what I do with my wife.
I have the marsh.
Joe's at a sale.
I went in July. Sit on top.
Welcome to the committee. Who'd like to start?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name, for the record, my name is Roy Johannes, and I'm representing the Fish and Wildlife Division of DNR. And I'm here to give you an update about VHS, and I would like to do, my goal is to give it to you in two stages. Recently, there was a discovery of VHS in the Lake Superior in Wisconsin and Michigan, and we have handouts, both Luke and I, that we would like to share today, both on Asian carp and VHS. And what I would like to do is to go over the research that was done by Cornell University, which identified new techniques for determining VHS, which is, from our standpoint in managing the virus in Minnesota, is very positive. The new techniques, however, that were discovered are not recognized by USD APHIS as a what they call the gold standard for measuring fish pathogens around the country. They still believe that cell tissue culture is the gold standard for measuring VHS. So although this research was done and has good evidence that VHS has been found in two areas of Wisconsin and Michigan, it is not confirmed by those agencies. However, from our standpoint, we believe that we should take this as a warning sign that VHS will probably be prominent. Now, from our standpoint in managing the virus in Lake Superior, we have not observed any fish kills or any of clinical signs of the virus. All the fish that were tested, there was 874 fish tested in 2009. They all were fish that were carriers of the virus and not showing clinical signs of the disease, which is hemorrhaging, bleeding, and what is called petechia of the eye, where the eye bulges and is bloodshot. Hopefully, Dr. Bowser, who conducted this study, will continue to do his research on these new highly sensitive techniques, which will be accepted by USD APHIS and give us a standard for being able to shrink the testing time from 30 days to 48 hours. With that behind us, I would like to go on and do the next step of what I want to present to you. DNR has taken an active role in managing the virus. And when USD APHIS in 2006 dealt with the interstate restriction on the movement of live fish in the Great Lakes states, we also took an actions that was necessary. Fortunately for us, USDA APHIS also provided grants for doing surveillance monitoring for the virus in Minnesota. And in 2007, 8, and 9, we have conducted testing around the state that have not found VHS in any of our waters at this time. We tested 86 lakes in 2007, 36 in 2008, and 27 recreational lakes in 2009, and we have a grant that will go through September of 2010 for additional surveillance testing. As an agency, we looked at two pathways in which the virus could enter Minnesota. One was Lake Superior, since four of the five Great Lakes had observed fish kills of the virus. And with the virus being found as far south as Milwaukee and Lake Michigan, we felt the area that where the Chicago Ship Canal enters Illinois River down to the Mississippi River is another pathway which we would see the virus come up. In late 2006, we set up planning to do surveillance monitoring both in Mississippi and Lake Superior, and at this time we have not identified the virus. We had several operations that we had going on Lake Superior in the Duluth area. We operate a cold water hatchery at French River. And we also had spawn taking operations, which we conducted on the St. Louis River. Beginning in 2008, we discontinued our walleye operations up there. We transferred the eggs that we needed for the St. Louis watershed to the Lake Vermilion strain of walleye and have been doing the stocking and replacement of fish for those areas from those waters. We discontinued use of the French River hatchery, which uses water from Lake Superior, as a short-term trout holding facility. We raised a majority of our trout in southeast Minnesota. We transported it up to northeast Minnesota for distribution and stocking for fishing opportunities. At that time, we were raising white sucker fry at the French River hatchery, which was used for our muskie program. In 2008, we transferred that program over to a dry diet program. Our staff were training in new hatchery techniques to accommodate that. We worked with the legislature to help us pass legislation that gave us authority to require testing before any stocking of fish in Minnesota for the VHS virus. In 2009, since we have one of the largest fish production programs in the state, we went through and tested all of our spawning stations for VHS, and all of our eggs were surface disinfected with iodine, which kills the virus before going into our hatcheries. And then we also tested all of our rearing ponds before our fish were stocked in the lakes. We'll continue the testing on the important key areas of Lake Superior and Mississippi River, and we'll also continue our monitoring our production programs in 2010. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
VHS is in Lake Superior now?
We believe it is. There were some recent findings of lake herring, which were confirmed by the culture tissue method, but those have not been confirmed by APHIS, and we feel that eventually we will see the spread of the virus within the basin. We have not had any experience in the Minnesota sector of Lake Superior where we've identified the virus, Mr. Chairman.
So the sheet you have here says the testing done by Cornell was funded in part by APHIS.
That's correct.
But they have not certified the findings.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Where is St. Louis Bay, Wisconsin?
St. Louis Bay, Wisconsin, Mr. Chairman, is right where Superior, Wisconsin meets the Nemadji River and it falls south of that. We call the area in Minnesota the St. Louis Estuary.
So it's in the Duluth Harbor?
It's in the Duluth Harbor. We recognize that, Mr. Chairman.
Under arrest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hannes, once a fish has been found with the virus, what is the timeline for the disease to take over and to spread and have a significant fish kill, or does that vary? Can it sometimes be very quick, other times slow? What's the usual expectation once a fish is, once you found that, to for a significant event to have taken place? For example, once it was found in Lake St. Clair, what happened?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that's a great question. And this virus is first identified in 2005. VHS is a virus that's been around the country for 40 years. However, it only affected trout and salmon. Within the last 4 years, it began infecting by a mutation cool and warm water fish like muskie, lake herring, whitefish, some of the other important species like walleye, bass, and so on. What we have seen in the other four Great Lakes, which have a tendency to warm up, have fast warm-ups in the springtime, especially when fish are in spawning activities and they're stressed out, the outbreak of the virus is very severe, and we see a lot of fish that succumb. Last year in Lake St. Clair, there was a fish kill that occurred with smallmouth bass and yellow perch. On the onset of the viewing the fish kill, it was determined that some of the fish kill may have been occurred by columnaris, which is what we call a disease that occurs when water warms up too fast during the spawning time. Upon further testing and so on, it was also found that those fish died because of the virus, because of the bleeding that was found in internal organs and so on. So the question you have is a real good one. However, we don't have a lot of answers right now. With a basin like Lake Superior, which has very cold temperatures, doesn't warm up to 70 degrees, which we found out is a very thermal limit of the virus. A lake in Michigan that was infected in 2008 exceeded temperatures of 70 degrees throughout the water column. And in 2009, when researchers went back to collect fish to look for the virus, they weren't able to find it. So we're finding out that possibly that there is some thermal limits of the virus. It's been primarily identified as a cold water virus. We're still learning a lot about it. We're learning about testing it. We're learning how to do hatchery methods that will keep the virus out of our lakes and streams and so on through our stocking practices, but we don't know when the next outbreak could occur.
Thank you.
Mr. Johannes, on the Cornell study, do you know, do you know what three locations were negative for VHS in the study?
Yes, the study was completed through sites of all the way through from Superior, Wisconsin to Paradise, Michigan. There was three sites in between those sites where it was not found. There was no testing done in Minnesota waters.
Those three other sites were in Wisconsin as well?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Why didn't they test Minnesota?
At the time, they had put in for additional grant money to do that. USDA decided that there was a higher priority and didn't give them the full complement of dollars they needed to complete the monitoring in Minnesota. And they were working with us as well, since we were doing our testing on our side, and we also tested all the fish at the French River hatchery.
Doesn't this sort of confirm that the primary way that VHS is transferred is through ballast discharge?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have an answer for that. There's many, many pathways in which the virus could have came by. It's suspected that commercial fishermen may have transferred some of the virus from Huron to the Paradise area, where they use nets from both from the same one lake and moved them to another. There's other waterways. You know, fish could have moved in from the canals and so on and transferred from other lakes. It ballast waters could be a possibility. We don't have a real clue as to how it arrived in Lake Superior.
Where's Paradise, Michigan?
That's right out where the Lake St. Clair entrances. It's right outside of the connection between Lake Superior and Lake Huron.
All right. So unless VHS can fly, it got to from there, Paradise, Michigan, to the Duluth Harbor and nowhere in between, somewhere else. So
Mr.
Probably hitched a ride.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. What may have occurred is that we've seen in our studies of Lake Erie, where VHS is very abundant, there are discrete populations of shiners and yellow perch that have not been found with the virus. So we've observed is that it does, when school fish together, they may have encountered the virus, and that stays with that school, and other discrete populations may not have had it, have originated.
But the location of these, of the positive testing being in harbors is a little uncanny, don't you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I could only speculate and say that, you know, we don't know all the methods that were used for collecting the fish. We don't know if there was could have been any contaminants in the sampling methods, how the homogenates were made. So there are some questions about the testing, and that's why we feel that we'll wait for USDA to make a final determination about the virus and its outcomes from the work that they funded.
So what has the DNR's response been?
Mr. Chairman, our response is that we have a concern about the virus, and we've had a lot of internal discussions about things, and we're stepping up all of our activities at our French River hatchery. Right now, we have a UV filter installed at our facility because we use Lake Superior water. It is known to kill the virus, and we'll continue to test our fish if we choose to move them inland. We also have a program where we've been moving some of our stocks, our Kamloops stocks, out to an inland hatchery in preparation for this, and we hope to continue that. We also are looking at some concerns about the upcoming smelt season, you know, whether there could be some opportunities. We're going to be doing some outreach as we have in the past. You probably have seen this. We did a VHS brochure when we tried to get our legislation passed. We'll be updating this. We'll continue to work on the prevention methods, and that is to try and get people not to move live fish between basins, not to move any water, not to move any bait that they use in VHS waters or potentially VH waters. Hot water will kill the virus, especially with the follow-up of drying of your boat for 12 hours and then rinse your boat. So there are precautions that are already in place. From our current rules right now, Dr. Skinner could answer that. We do have Lake Superior designated as an infested water, which requires all these things to be in place. So we feel that we're prepared for that, and we'll just monitor and evaluate, conduct surveillance as we need to.
None of that sounds like it will prevent the fish from the Duluth Harbor from being killed off. Is that just inevitable?
Mr. Chairman, we don't know what to expect as far as an outbreak. You know, we only saw two outbreaks in 2009, where there were seven in 2008 and 11 in 2007. So a lot depends on environmental conditions, how fast waters warm up in the springtime, how concentrated fish are, and whether they're stressed or not, so that the fish will be an outbreak. We don't know if they're actually could be a fish kill, just at the fact that the virus could be present at Lake Superior because of the cold nature of the lake.
So if someone asks me what are we doing about VHS, my answer can be there isn't much we can do.
Well, prevention and education is our best steps right now, Mr. Chairman.
Once we have it, there's not much we can do.
Mr. Chairman, we're hoping that research shows that, you know, we'd be able to, you know, kill the virus in warm water conditions. We'll have the preventions. We'll take the steps necessary to prevent it from entering our production systems. You know, we find out that, you know, we have some research that's shown that the virus does not pass from adult to progeny. You know, we can take steps in between. So we also believe that some of the fish will develop some immunity to it, like any other virus, just like we do with common cold and other things. So time will tell. There's just about only 5 years of research in dealing with this, so we have a lot to learn yet.
Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the invasive species program for the Minnesota DNR. On the prevention side, I just want to mention that what Mr. Johannes mentioned, that Lake Superior and the Duluth Harbor are designated as infested waters. So that means right now you cannot move water. You can't move any prohibited species. You cannot move aquatic plants. And because it's also infested with invasive fishes, it means you can't even harvest bait fish from that area. So there's already things in place that are ongoing. Working with our conservation officers, we'll be stepping up our actions around the areas, even though right now, as we said, it's likely there but not confirmed. We're still going to be stepping up actions around the area to try to help prevent the spread. This is no different for us in the program than dealing with zebra mussels or other things and trying to prevent the spread. So enforcement and education will be picked up significantly around the Duluth Harbor and all those areas as well.
About ballast?
Ballast water, Mr. Chairman, is right now regulated through by the PCA and the process. The big challenge, as you already mentioned, the big challenge right now is the process. They have the permitting process, all the ships. They're on a timeline for being able to put onboard ballast water technologies to filter these things, and most of those go out to 2016. Right now, the Coast Guard is putting in some new rules that hopefully will be adopted across the Great Lakes region, so all states will be treating it the same, and those rules have been out for comment right now. So the Pollution Control Agency is driving that force, and we're trying to work with them on that as they try to get all the ships into compliance at this time.
But an infected water designation does not impose anything different on ballast discharge. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, most of the water being discharged is not coming from infested waters. Most of the waters are taken on in other Great Lakes, which we have no authority to designate. And so you're correct that there's no authority for that discharge. If they actually take on water within the Great Lakes, it's hard to know. There is ballast. There's some ballast kind of regulation that goes on all the time for safety in ships. But right now, the regulations and that monitoring is going on through PCA.
Senator Bibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. One is kind of building on your question. Is there ever an instance where an invasive species, an invasive exotic species of whatever type, aquatic or terrestrial plant or animal, has actually been eradicated once it's established itself in Minnesota?
Senator Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble. It's a rarity. It's a rarity that we ever be able to eradicate something. The one time we've done it in recent years was a new aquatic plant was found in Powderhorn Lake in the Minneapolis called Brazilian Eladia, or Brazilian waterweed. It's a 12-acre lake. It's small. We found it. We didn't think it could survive here, yet it had been there for more than a couple years by its distribution. We worked with the city to actually draw the water down, turn off the aeration system, and treat it. And so far, 2 years later, it's now the third year, we've not been able to find it. But that is the exception. Most time when we find invasive species, there's a time lag. It's 2 to 3 years or 4 years after when we actually find them in that spot, and they're usually established. For some species, we can manage. We can actually manage their impacts. But for things like zebra mussels and VHS, there are no controls. So once they get into a system, it's really trying to prevent their spread to new areas of the state.
So, Mr. Chair, that's the point I was hoping would be made. Senator Rust and I have been keeping an eye on this ballast water thing. Senator Rust has been very, very active in this issue and, of course, frustrated by, pleadings to not act and to allow the feds to simply act. And, you know, the PCA now has stepped forward, which is good, you know, to act in the absence of regs that have come down from, so it's the Coast Guard who was supposed to do something. So, Mr. Chair, is the Coast Guard moving forward at all, or are we going to see any sort of federal regimen?
Absolutely, Senator Dibble. Mm-hmm. They are requiring every fishing guide, regardless of the size of the boat, to understand all the navigable waters and understand what color lights are on a submarine. Also, we don't spread VHS.
So, I guess our best prospect then at this point is to slow it down. But as we know, it only takes one. You know, one person kind of slipping through the cracks. So based on our experience in other nearby Great Lakes, should we be rightly worried about VHS getting into more of our inland surface waters, and what kind of timeline can we expect to start seeing them show up in some of our other lakes in Minnesota?
Johannes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, what we've seen is that there's only one breach that's gone outside of the Great Lakes watershed, and that was in a reservoir in southern Ohio where the muskie population was found infected. And right now, continuous surveillance is being done there, but it was found in the adult muskie population. And as far as sensitivity to certain fish, we found that the most sensitive fish to VHS are lake herring, which is an important fish in Lake Superior, lake whitefish, muskellunge, and then it gets down into northern pike, and then walleye, smallmouth bass, and the trout species are pretty much very more tolerant than the other species. But that was the only breach so far, was a reservoir in southern Ohio.
Mr. Johannes, does the DNR trap its bait at all, or does it raise at all, or is it... Where does DNR get its bait from?
Mr. Chairman, are you looking at ways that we're raising our muskie forage, our muskie program? There's two ways that we use a forage as minnows for feeding muskies. One is we purchase from local vendors that are around our muskie ponds, Hinckley area, Park Rapids area, Bemidji area. And then we also trap some minnows on our own as part of our incidental catch of testing our walleye ponds and so on for feeding our fish. But that's, it's very, very concentrated. And as a result of our monitoring our populations, we tested all those stocks before they went out for stocking.
Do the bait get tested, quarantined, and tested before they go into your forage program?
Mr. Chairman, we're only testing the species that are susceptible to VHS, and there's 38 species that are on the list. Fathead minnows, which is the primary forage used, has not been tested. However, we are testing the fish after they've consumed them, the minnows, so that we know that the stocks are good and VHS-free before going out.
Further questions on the VHS? On the Asian carp. Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to give you an update on this. I'll also answer questions if you have just on the program, as we've already heard a little bit today already, at the end if you like. I did provide a handout, just in a nutshell. There's Asian carp. When they talk about Asian carp, it's a suite of species, including big head, black, grass, and silver carp. Many of them were released in the southern part of the United States in fishing ponds that, where catfish are raised to control and eat plankton. And in the floods, the lower parts of the reaches, they've escaped into the Mississippi River and been working their way up the Mississippi River for quite a while.
The Asian carp is technically... The what?
The big head.
The big head.
Black, grass, and silver carp.
Oh, so when we refer to Asian carp, there are actually
four species.
Four species.
The two biggies that we hear about the most are the big head carp and the silver carp, and that's the ones we see the most. We're starting to see grass carp as well. We have not seen black carp at all yet. So,
big head and silver are the jumping type?
Silver are the jumpers. Big head don't really jump, but they get very large, up to 100 pounds in size. Silver carp are the jumpers. You see all the videos of people getting hit and jumping through boats, or the archers out there trying to shoot them with their bows out of the front of the boats as they're zooming down the rivers. But right now, there's three fronts where Asian carp can get into Minnesota waters. The first is up the Mississippi River. They've been moving up the Mississippi River for quite some time. And since as early as 2003, they caught the first grass carp, or 1996, they caught the first grass carp. But more recently, in the last 3 years, they've been, the commercial fishermen down between Winona and the Iowa border have been catching more and more grass carp. I'm sorry, grass carp, silver carp, one silver carp, and several big heads. And that's a real concern, where we used to see one every two or three years. In 2008 and 2009, there was 8 to 10 carp caught, always high as Winona, up to pool 5. And now just in 2010, just a couple weeks ago, they caught 5 grass carp down in pool 6, which is just below Winona. So they're starting to move their way up the river. This is quicker than we thought, and it's a real concern. So that's the most direct route into Minnesota. The second route is what we've been hearing about over in Chicago, the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal, where the Asian carp are now moving up that canal system through the Des Plaines River into the canals. And now, because there's that connection, they're likely, or the concern is that they'll get into the Great Lakes and work their way through Lake Michigan. There is a barrier in the river in the Sanitary Ship Canal in Chicago. There's been a demonstration barrier there for a long time. And just recently, they turned on a new barrier to help. Actually, they originally put in there to keep round gobies and other species from getting from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi River Basin. You know, when they built this canal about 100 years ago, it's the only connection now of two of the greatest, largest basins in the United States. Now more than half the countries now can be affected by either something in the Mississippi River or something in the Great Lakes Basin, because now they can move back and forth through this section. And so electrical barriers put in place to try to prevent the spread. The concern was, though, they have a new technique. Similar to the VHS, they are testing a new technique for detecting Asian carp called environmental DNA, eDNA, where they're testing the water. And they found suspected samples or detected samples, what they think of Asian carp, in particular bighead carp, DNA in the water above the barrier, between the barrier and Lake Michigan. And so there's several ways it can get in there from there. It branches in almost 5 different ways. 2 of them are major locks. And what you might have heard earlier, that the Attorney General's Office of Michigan, State of Michigan, and then followed suit by Minnesota and Wisconsin, joined in that suit to try to have emergency closure of the 2 major locks there until they can determine a plan to prevent the spread of Asian carp into Lake Michigan, and the Supreme Court refused to hear it. So at this point, it's still open. But the Army Corps of Engineers is still working on a plan, working with the City of Chicago and Illinois and Wisconsin on a way to help prevent that. It's another barrier that's going to be in place by next year. They're going to have 2 electrical barriers. They're looking at other treatments of using rotenone and fish products to kill the fish in the system to help prevent the spread. But these are short term fixes. Without having something more permanent in place, there's likely that Asian carp will get into Lake Michigan and eventually come around through Michigan into Lake Superior. But that's the long route into Minnesota waters compared to the Mississippi, but it's still a great concern. So there's a lot of work going on right now. They have a commission down there working on it, trying to develop a long-term plan. But in the meantime, there's this concern that they're already beyond the barrier and potentially getting into Lake Michigan. So that's the second one. The third one is that now the Missouri River Basin and some of the watersheds that edge up against Minnesota in South Dakota are now infested with bighead carp as well. And so the concern about illegal, import of fish or bait fish, things like that, or even permitted stuff, is of real concern. So those are some of the key ways. Those 3 parts are the ones. So I call that the back door, because we're not talking about South Dakota and those populations are moving up that way, but we know we got it coming up the Mississippi. So the big responses are what's happening. We were looking at technologies to put at a lock and dam, such as a sound and bubble barrier, to try to help prevent the slow spread of Asian carp up the river. But the only way that's going to happen is in conjunction with the Army Corps of Engineers. The river is federally navigable waters. It's managed by them, and the locks and dams are owned by them. We worked with our congressional delegation through our commissioner and to try to get more action on the river. There was the WRDA, the Water Resource Development Act of 2007, actually put language in for the Army Corps of Engineers to work on a barrier to try to prevent the spread upstream, but they never appropriated any funding for it. And because of that, the Corps of Engineers has been unwilling to actually start on this process. But we're still trying to ramp up and work with them on potential actions and what we could do on the Mississippi River, as well as all the work's going on over in Chicago.
Where would the barrier go, and how much does it cost?
Right now, the estimation would be, depends where the fish are. That's part of it. Originally, they talked to Iowa. Now we're looking up as high as maybe Red Wing. You're talking, for installation, that $5 million range and $1 million a year to manage, to monitor, to maintain, depending on, that's Those are guesses at this point. And so those are some of the real concerns. Again, then that might not be 100% foolproof. That's something that could help slow the spread. Other alternatives that have been discussed is looking at physical barriers. And right now, the most latest we've been talking about is trying to maintain the idea is what to do with the Coon Rapids Dam, for example. And the Coon Rapids Dam is there. It's in dire need of some work. But at the same time, it is a natural fish barrier right now. And the St. Anthony Falls used to be that way. For hundreds of years, the St. Anthony Falls was a natural fish barrier until the Lock and Dam was put in there. And really, we had two distinct groups of species of fish above and below that. And there's been studies that have shown that. And right now, the de facto barrier is just above that at Coon Rapids. And so this is one idea. But there's still opportunities to potentially do something downstream. But as the fish move up, those go away much more quickly because we just don't have those opportunities to help look at spread. So we're still looking at those physical barriers that are already in place that we can maintain. And then what are some options down below? The other thing I would like to mention is that some of the rivers that are most heavily infested, like the Illinois River, are pretty highly degraded systems. And we see really high populations of Asian carps, up to 90% biomass in certain sections of the river. But the Mississippi is not like that. The Mississippi is actually a fairly healthy river compared to the parts of the Illinois. And we don't know for sure or not, but those healthy systems and maintaining those healthy systems can actually allow our native species to be more competitive, and we might not see the same impact. So we don't know actually what the impacts are going to be compared to some of those systems that are much more degraded with that. And
Senator Rest.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Skinner. In the Chicago system, when they are doing maintenance, they have to poison the water and kill all the fish while they're doing the maintenance so that no fish gets through, any fish. In the new barriers that they are planning, is that particular control measure, poisoning the water, going to be necessary as well, or can they maintain it without having to poison the water?
Mr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, if you're unfamiliar, this past fall they needed to turn off the one barrier, the new barrier they installed for maintenance, and what's interesting, it's like on a six-month cycle. It's
I know, really low.
It's
very frequent.
And right now they had no other barrier to stop it. They had a demonstration barrier, which they didn't think was adequate. So they treated about 6 miles of river downstream from the barrier to kill off all the carp in the river prior to turning the barrier off for maintenance. And they did that. They used 450 people from six states, and it cost millions of dollars to do. From it, they recovered one Asian carp. Is that good or bad? It's the fact that they did. That's what they got, and they did the maintenance. The idea is if they install the second barrier, which is supposed to go online in September of 2010, then they can rotate them. They can only turn them off, and then they'll have two barriers that are not far apart where they can turn one off. It's what you do in between. So they might have to do some treatments of a much smaller area between the barriers when that comes to thing. But, yes, they think they'll have to use it, but at a much smaller scale compared to what they did this past fall in Chicago.
On the back of your handout, you've got a pie chart of general expenditures out of the invasive species account. That's why I thought it was curious that it's only boaters and anglers that are paying into the invasive species account for the most part. I see there's some general fund and some LCMR, but primarily anglers, boaters. But that's for all invasive species. But the bigger question I had was, why does fully 19% of the account spent on administration and coordination?
Mr. Chairman, the budget here reflects the invasive species account, which is a surcharge on boat license, a $5 surcharge on boat license, and a $2 surcharge on non-resident fishing licenses. And that's about half the budget. The other half of the budget is general fund, just for clarification. The state and regional coordination is all the work that we do with Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, trying to prevent the other species from getting here. That's all the work we do, working with Chicago, when we spent the time down there. We work with the Great Lakes Panel on invasive species on a variety of work. And so this is and also internal work we do with all the other states as well. So the coordination is more like my time that I use to do and that. Right now, about 45% of our time is on control and management of invasive species that we have here. All of our public awareness, the vast majority of the state and regional coordination, and the inspections and enforcement is all about prevention. So if you look at the actual totals, there's as much spent on prevention as there is on management, less the administration.
Why do you need 11% for administration?
Shared services for the department and for the division. It's outlined in our annual report. Our full annual report actually outlines the details of all these categories. And we provide it. I can certainly provide it again to anybody who would like it. So.
Last question, then, Senator, folks. Chicago or the Illinois DNR, they instituted a bounty on carp. Is that the case? So do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware of that yet. I do know that they've been having some fishing contests down there, and there has been some commercial harvest as a method of trying to reduce populations in certain parts of the river. So, and they're trying to utilize the fish and trying to find ways to utilize the fish within the river. But I'm not sure if there's – I'm unaware of a actual bounty at this point.
Any of those things being considered here?
Right now, we are not considering – we can step back. We talked about this actually in the House yesterday as well. Think back to common carp and trying to manage common carp through harvest. And the same thing, you can reduce the population sometimes, but a lot of times you just change the structure, the age structure from a lot of big, from a few big fish to a lot of little fish. It can be a tool that can be used to help manage, but by itself alone, it's not going to manage the populations in the river. But I think if there can be some utilization of Asian carp as they come in and we can get some good harvest on them, it certainly would help a little bit. But to know how much by itself, it's not going to be a sole tool. So,
I was just asking if that's something you're considering, proposing, or instituting.
Mr. Chairman, commercial fishermen right now are harvesting them. At this point, it's illegal to actually have Asian carp, so we'd have to change statute at that point. But we have not considered it as a tool yet. At this point, we don't have them in the river to harvest yet. So.
I thought you said there were some found already.
Mr. Chairman, yes, they catch them incidentally when they're fishing for all other species in the river. And so when they get a big net full of fish, they're very good about looking through them, and they're finding ones and twos. And as I said, in the last year, they found only, I think, a total of 8 carp in 2009, so it's still fairly low. And for all the thousands and thousands of pounds of fish that they catch, and this year so far, they've found 5. So it's they catch them in their harvest, and they're doing what they're told by law. They're required to notify us when they do catch Asian carp in their nets.
But the law requires them to be returned to the water.
No. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. No, they can't return them to the water. They actually keep them, and they notify them. They're usually confiscated by the DNR.
Okay.
And disposed of.
Senator Fredrickson, then Dibble.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, if we'd have a bounty in Minnesota on Asian carp, I would assume it would not be wanted dead or alive. It would be wanted dead. I do have a couple other questions for Mr. Skinner. In southwest Minnesota, would the Des Moines River be a possible route to Asian carp into Minnesota? Do they not connect with the infested waters?
Mr. Chairman, sir. Senator, yes, it could be a route coming up through, because I believe the Des Moines flows into the Missouri system, and then so that's all interconnected.
It maybe should be a concern of ours at some point in the near future. The other question I had is how much is known about the life cycle and reproduction and breeding habits of these other carp, the Asian carp and the big-headed carp, and do we know enough about their habits and the way they spawn and reproduce, so that might be the possible help in controlling.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, yes, we do have a number of researchers that are studying the life cycles of these. Some of the carp, like the silver carp, need long stretches of river for reproduction. We found that three main concerns, the black, the big head, and the silver, require very warm seasonal temperatures for reproduction, and that's close to 80 degrees. So that those are things that we'd be looking at in Minnesota is not typically reaching those temperatures till mid-July. The smaller fish that you would find from the reproduction need to attain a certain size during the summer for them to overwinter to the next winter. And I'll give you some analogies. For us in Minnesota, to have a largemouth bass overwinter, it has to reach the 2-inch size by August 1st to have a good chance of overwintering. And we would be looking at measuring those types of fish condition measurements to learn how the species could survive or be successful in Minnesota. So they're, you know, so far it's been in more of the warmer water climates, very similar to where they came from in China.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. Are they edible?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble? Yes, they're right now being used and processed for a variety of things, both I think some for human consumption, but more for feed for animals at this point. So unless Roy, you know more, but I think that's no. They're certainly trying to utilize them now, and they're looking for markets as well.
And, Senator Dibble, my dad can email you a nice carp curry recipe.
I look forward to it.
It works really well.
Mr. Chair, I spent some time in Russia, and they served us carp literally for breakfast. We're talking a lot about rivers. But are we worried about our lakes ultimately?
Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, as Mr. Johannes has pointed out, they are mostly a riverine fish. So if they get into the Great Lakes, we're uncertain about what the impacts might be on Lake Superior. They may not be that much, but it's a transit route to get to some of our bigger river systems, such as the St. Louis River estuary and some of the others. The North Shore streams may not be as conducive, and I think some of the internal river systems in Minnesota, like the Minnesota River and Mississippi, are much more susceptible than any of the North Shore streams. But certainly the estuary up in Duluth can be impacted. But it's what impacts on the Great Lakes itself is yet to be is unknown.
And Mr. Chair, the smaller inland lakes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, there really isn't a lot of information about the impacts in smaller lakes. We've observed some of the studies that have been done when grass carp have been introduced in lakes. They usually outgrow the demand of vegetation that's in there. However, reproduction is more of in a riverine situation. It would be more of a comparison like steelhead species. They need to have the riverine area to reproduce. So the lake areas may not provide that reproduction. However, the adults would enter the lake and be long-term.
The Minnesota State Management Plan for Invasive Species that was completed in late 2009 by the Minnesota Invasive Species Advisory Council, could you email that plan to members by the end of the week?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we'll do it right away.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. As long as I have Mr. Skinner's attention, I want to put cattails on his radar. Cattails have become an issue in my district. We have invasive cattails, but they're not classified as such, and they're wrecking some of the Senate District 60's beautiful bodies of water, so I want to talk about those.
Thank you. Okay. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you. Yeah, big cattails.